Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard oral arguments today on the state's controversial voter ID law. A WPR news reporter who is in the court today joins us to share the latest news on the case.
But first, we'll learn about how to get your best brain ever. Our guest expert has tips and strategies you can use to improve your memory and brain function.
And you can get a copy of our guest's new book and support great radio here on WPR with your pledge of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Cynthia Green joins us now. She's a psychologist and co-author of Your Best Brain Ever, a complete guide and workout. Cynthia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So a lot of us assume that as we get older, our brains go downhill and we're doomed to become more forgetful and less sharp. What does neuroscience have to say about that?
Well, first of all, I think that there is not really evidence that we're doomed and that our brains go south. In fact, there's many things that get better as we grow older. And so one of the things that we've done in Your Best Brain Ever is provide people with really a current understanding of all of the science around brain health, both in terms of what happens to our brain, not just with age, but also with injury or, you know, with daily function, kind of what happens when we're distracted, what happens when we don't get sleep, and then also give a lot of information and practical advice about what we can do. So what the science shows us we can do to better maintain our everyday performance and also our long-term brain health. So there's a lot that we know now that we didn't know before from the science. And while aging can make it more difficult to do things like maybe remember a name, we know that there's a lot that we can do to stay sharp day to day, and also that we may be able to do to lower our risk for serious memory disorders.
So in terms of reversing the clock, is that possible? It'd be nice to think that we could come out of the gate as children and our parents would do everything right and we'd have beautiful, sharp brains all our lives. But what if we're getting late to the party and we're, you know, 50, 60 years old and we want to work on it then? Is it possible to make improvements?
So certainly when it comes to our brain's health, we can make improvements all the time. There was a study recently in a group of older adults that showed that with training, they were even able to improve their performance. That said, it's not as if we're turning back the clock, right? Our brains are the age that they are in the same way that we are the age that we are. However, I think that we have gotten kind of more commonly to accept this notion that it's how we take care of ourselves that really matters. So our chronological age may be one thing, but the age at which we function in terms of things like our physical health really is dictated by how well we take care of ourselves, and the same is true for our brains. So there are many things we can do to take good care of our brains so that we can maintain that function and function well for longer.
Well, let's talk about some of those things. What are some of the most important things we can do to take care of our brains and ourselves?
So in Your Best Brain Ever and in the work that I do, we talk a lot about the ways that we engage for brain health. And when we look at the science of brain health, really, there are many things that we need to do across the physical, intellectual, and social and emotional dimensions of wellness to support brain health. So there are things that many of your listeners probably already do know and do themselves. For example, getting regular aerobic exercise. We know that when we get aerobic activity on a regular basis, our brains are just healthier. It keeps our brains physiologically more well and can lower our risk for other kinds of diseases, such as stroke, that can make it difficult to remember or raise our risk for a memory disorder.
So exercise improves the brain. Why? What happens when we exercise in the brain?
So, you know, it's not always clear, but certainly we know that we get better blood flow to the brain. That when we exercise, we are increasing the presence in our brain of different materials that support good health for the neurons, things like brain-derived nootropic factor and other factors that support both the growth of new neurons in the hippocampus, which is the part of our brain most responsible for learning new things, and also in terms of our brain's ability to make new connections, right? So to put down new pathways, that is supported through exercise. We also know that when we get regular exercise, we have an associated reduction in risk for other kinds of diseases, what we call medical comorbidities, that in turn may make it more likely we'll develop a serious memory disorder. So things such as stroke or high blood pressure or obesity or diabetes, which is increasingly associated with Alzheimer's disease. So there's a lot of good things that come out of aerobic activity. The other thing that comes out of aerobic activity on research is that when people get regular aerobic exercise, they do better on intellectual tests. And this has been shown over and over in the laboratory and also in self-reports when people talk about exercising, that they just do better on tests of attention, on tests of reasoning, and tests of memory. And then finally, when people report exercising regularly, they seem to have an associated reduced risk for dementia over their lifetime. So that's a lot of bang for your buck when it comes to aerobic activity.
Now, in your book, Your Best Brain, you include lots of exercises that people can do that might help get to that best brain, can help improve things and help keep the brain sharp. And I wonder if we could talk about some of those. One thing that you recommend doing is wearing your watch upside down. What does that do for your brain?
Everybody loves that activity, and it's a great one to talk about because it's something that everyone who's listening can go ahead and do, right? Everyone right now who's listening can take their watch off, and they can go ahead and turn it upside down. So the activities program that we embedded in Your Best Brain Ever was a way of taking that science and giving people practical ways that they could incorporate it into their daily routine immediately so that they could benefit from what they were reading about and that it wasn't just kind of, you know, something out there that they would have to figure out on their own. So the 58 activities that are included are lots of different activities for expanding your brain's activity or for trying new strategies for remembering all reflect the science that you're reading. When you wear your watch upside down, what does it do? If you think about it, Veronica, when we wear a watch and we look at that watch, our brain is processing visual information in the same way that we learn to do probably in second or third grade, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we turn our watch upside down, what we're doing is we're forcing our brain to break up that pattern. And it's a very simple way that we're challenging ourselves to think out of a routine, out of something that we become so habituated to that we do it unconsciously. We're going to make our brain be then more conscious about the effort, reprocess that same visual information in a completely different way, and have to set down a different kind of neural path to understand and interpret it. And by doing small things like that, which another psychologist by the name of Lawrence Katz termed neurobics, these kind of short little ways of bursting out of our brain's usual box, that we're going to be setting up new ways every day to intellectually challenge our brain.
That's awesome. Now neurobics.
Yeah. So, and that, you know, that is in addition to doing things that we traditionally think of as intellectually engaging. And there have been many studies that have shown that people who are intellectually challenged have an associated reduced risk for memory loss over their lifetime, and that finding is pretty robust. So we've seen it in a number of different populations in large longitudinal studies. So we need to do those things too, the things that your listeners maybe think of as traditionally being kind of brain challenging, like learning a new language or taking a hobby or planning a trip or reading or joining a reading group. But these are other small things that we can incorporate into our daily routine that do something similar.
And you've got more than 50 of these activities in the book. We'll talk more about them when we come back. We're continuing our conversation now with psychologist Cynthia Green about her new book called Your Best Brain Ever, A Complete Guide and Workout. Cynthia, you mentioned the importance of completing tasks under time pressure. Why is that a good thing?
One of the things that happens as we grow older is that the intellectual skills that are most challenged are things such as our attention, our processing speed, which determines how quickly we can solve or think through information, our ability to think flexibly in terms of multitasking, and also memory, among others. But those are the major ones. And of course, if we sit back and think about it, memory really relies on learning. And if we're going to learn something, we have to be able to pay attention, we have to be able to think quickly, and we have to think flexibly. So if we, for example, use the learning task of learning someone's name, when we learn that name, we first have to get it, so we have to pay attention. We have to be able to think quickly to get it because a name comes at us very fast. And then we have to think flexibly, because we're very rarely in a situation where the only thing we're doing at that moment is learning a name. We might be at a party. We might be at a work meeting. It might be a noisy environment. So we need to be able to do those things well to learn the information. So a lot of times what we think of as a memory issue is really an issue of these other skills breaking down as we grow older. The good news is that much of the research has shown that we can train those skills, and by training them, we can better maintain them so that we can stay sharp in those areas and mediate what happens with age by working those skills out. One of the simplest ways we can do that is play against the clock. When we play a game against the clock, what we're doing is we're forced to pay attention, because we can't do well if we're not paying attention. We have to work quickly, and we have to be flexible in our thinking. So many times we can do a task that works on memory. So this is, by the way, where a lot of the brain fitness software products that are on the market come in.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about being brain fitness, but what they're really doing is helping to sharpen these very skills that are more challenged as we grow older. But we can do anything against the clock to do that. And I think if many of us kind of think about the kinds of ways we engage that support brain health, one of the things we don't do is timed activities. And I'm asked all the time if stuff at work, you know, if I'm working against a deadline, if that matters. It's not quite the same thing.
So you're talking more about, you know, trying to complete a task quickly. You're looking at the clock and it's running down. You've got to get it done.
Right. So things like games on your cell phone. Probably most of us at this point have cell phones, and many of our providers have games that we can download, and they're usually timed. Or the kinds of games that we could play on a handheld device. There's a great game called Simon that is put out by Milton Bradley, which is a very old-fashioned game. It's been around for a while.
Yeah, I used to play Simon. That's with the different colors, and you have to repeat them back to different tones. And
and you have to remember the sequence. Right?
Yeah.
And it gets faster and harder the more that you remember. Other great games for people, for example, who like crossword puzzles, they could play Boggle, or there's another great game out there called Zip It, which is put out by the same company that brought us Bananagrams. We can play games against each other. We really like, Bananagrams is an example, or you can play games on your phone that are these word games where you're not only playing against the clock, but playing against friends. And then finally, there's the brain fitness software products themselves. So there's a lot out there. And if you don't want to do any of this and you love your crossword puzzle, then start timing yourself when you do the crossword puzzle. Force yourself to play these things against the clock.
So using the clock as a tool, I like that. And there's another one that I love. It seems like it would be fun to do, is playing with fragrances. Exposing yourself, it sounds like, to different fragrances can be good for your brain.
Yes, and you know, it's really interesting because we think about our brain and keeping our brain healthy. We often really just think about ways of engaging in activities that we feel are intellectual, right? And a lot of times those are very verbal activities where we're, problem solving or doing a puzzle. But in fact, our brain is really, the recipient of all the sensory information. And one of the things that changes as we grow older is our olfactory sense. So our sense of smell can change. So challenging our sense of smell, doing things like taking different spices and kind of closing our eyes and trying to remember what they are. Or another one that we have in the book is to create what we call like a little black box where you put in objects and then you curtain it so you can't see what you're feeling, and try using your sense of touch to identify those objects. Those are other great ways that we can involve our brain and kind of challenge it.
You also recommend something that should be fairly easy for a lot of people, and that is to be social. Just interacting with other people, it sounds like, boosts your brain power. Why does that work?
So socialization is something, yes, that is fun to do. And sometimes people don't think about how intellectually engaging it is. When we socialize, first of all, we're forced to work out those very skills that we just talked about. You can't have a good conversation without paying attention, thinking quickly and thinking flexibly, and remembering what they said and what you want to say, so that it challenges all those same skills. And it's, in a way, its own timed activity, because if you're sitting there taking forever to respond in a conversation, you're not going to really be a good part of that conversational team, right? You're going to get kind of left behind. So in that way, socialization is very good for these kind of skills training, for these intellectual skills we use day to day. Also, I think that for many of us, we tend to be more involved intellectually in different kinds of really think-out-of-the-box, challenging activities when we go with a friend or a family, so that we're more likely to go to a movie or a concert or to a lecture, to take a class, to travel, all those kinds of things that we know support better intellectual engagement are more likely to be done if we do it with somebody else. When we socialize, we have really great emotional support, which is very important to brain health as well.
And Cynthia, in our last 30 seconds here, what is one simple thing that anyone can do to improve their brain and get to that best brain you're talking about?
Get out and get engaged. One of my colleagues said we should do walking book clubs with friends. Anything that we do that gets us to kind of hook in physically, intellectually, and socially will be great for your brain.
Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to have you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And that was Cynthia Green, psychologist and co-author of Your Best Brain Ever, A Complete Guide and Workout.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case that could help determine the future of voter ID laws here in Wisconsin.
Governor Walker and the Republican-led legislature passed a voter ID law in 2011, but it's been on hold pending legal challenges. A lawsuit filed by the League of Women Voters led to a Dane County circuit judge invalidating that law in 2012. Later, a state appeals court upheld the measure. Now the state Supreme Court is getting ready to weigh in.
Our own Gilman Halstead was there for the arguments today. He joins us in the studio now. Gilman, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
So actually two lawsuits
right.
got wrapped up into one. Can you give us a little background and tweak out those lawsuits and what exactly they were challenging?
Sure. The League of Women Voters one is the easiest to describe. It challenges the law on the basis of the state constitution and basically says that the legislature doesn't have the authority to limit the ability of people to vote at the polls. It does have the ability and has in the past, and the Constitution has made that clear, to regulate how, where, and when people vote, but not who they are when they go to the polls, except to the extent that it's described in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the lawsuits.
Right.
And then the other was NAACP,
yeah, the
right?
NAACP, along joined by Voces de la Frontera. And that suit basically says that the voter ID law imposes a significant burden on a substantial number of people, a burden on their right to vote, because it's difficult for elderly people, poor people, and a whole range of people to actually get the identification that the law requires that they have when they go to the polls.
So they're saying this creates a class of voters who
right.
can't vote, whereas the Constitution says, yes, you can do that with felons and some others, but they're saying it's a new class of voters that couldn't vote
right.
under the law.
Right.
And so, in effect,
it's not that they couldn't vote. It's
right.
that it imposes a significant
burden.
Gotcha.
Okay. And so, because of these lawsuits, have we ever actually had the voter ID law in effect during an election?
You know, it was in place for a spring election.
Oh, right,
in
right.
2012. But then it was enjoined right after that. So it's not been in place, not been enforced during a large general election.
So what did we hear in court today?
Well, we heard from Lester Pines for the League of Women Voters that it's clear, their argument is that it's clear that the state constitution does not allow the legislature to impose this kind of restriction, and that it's just on its face is unconstitutional. That was a very straightforward argument. And from the state attorney general's office, Clay Kosky, who was arguing it, said that that claim is not completely true because the Constitution doesn't expressly forbid the legislature from doing this. Some of the justices point out it also does not expressly allow them to. So it's a nuance.
So this is part one today. What's happening tomorrow? Is this still, does this keep going?
No. Well, nothing's going to happen tomorrow.
Okay.
I mean, they're
they're done for now.
Yes, they're done for now. They've heard the arguments. And I guess one of the interesting things about the argument that we didn't expect was that a conservative Supreme Court justice actually raised some concerns about the law, or we might expect that she would not have, concerns that it might involve a poll tax, in a sense, because it costs money to get a birth certificate if you don't have one, and therefore you would be charging someone to vote. So Patience Rokensack raised that question, and that was kind of a surprise to lots of observers.
And the Attorney General had been wanting the Supreme Court to take this up for a while now, right? In the last couple of years. Why now?
Well, that's a good question. It went up to the appeals court, and the Supreme Court put it off until the appeals court finally made some rulings on it and convinced, and lawyers for both sides convinced the Supreme Court that they really needed to address it. And then I think another point we should make is that there is still a federal lawsuit. The NAACP lawsuit is still pending before federal judge Lynn Edelman. And regardless of what happens here at the state Supreme Court, he could be weighing in at any point on that.
So for this thing, voter ID law, to be in effect for our big fall elections,
right,
has to be cleared by the Supreme Court and the federal
yes,
court?
Yes, yeah, and the federal court. And that's unlikely because no matter what happens at the federal court level, it will probably go to the federal appeals court. Mm-hmm. Which has already ruled on the Indiana voter ID law, and has upheld it. But there are questions about whether they will uphold Wisconsin's because it is somewhat more stringent.
Is there a notion that this ultimately might end up before the U.S., the federal Supreme Court?
Yes, I think that whether or not it's the Wisconsin law itself that ends up before the Supreme Court, it's likely that the issues the substance of what's in the Wisconsin law, which is also in some other state voter IDs laws that are being challenged, will end up before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, okay. So even if our specific Wisconsin case doesn't go, another state might ultimately resolve the issue for us.
That's right.
So are we ever going to see this thing in place? I mean, I know I don't want to ask you to predict the future.
No, but I won't predict it. But Lester Pines today had to kind of stop himself short. He's the attorney for the League of Women Voters challenging that. He expressed a lot of confidence that it was going to be struck down. Mm-hmm. Now, the attorney for the state did not talk to reporters afterwards, but they made their argument before the court today saying that they really believe this is constitutional and that it will someday be in place. So that's the best I can do. Those who are challenging it are really convinced we're never going to see it in place.
And elsewhere in the Capitol, we've talked about this before. There was an effort in the Assembly, I think it was, right, to change the voter ID law. Where did that all go?
Well, the Assembly passed that, and it addresses an important issue that did come up in the arguments today, which has to do with the ability of a voter to swear an affidavit if they don't have the voter ID, to basically say, to give a reason and swear to it why they could not get that ID and still have the ability to vote. The Assembly passed that, but the Senate has not. And the indications we're hearing from the leader of the Senate, Scott Fitzgerald, are that he would rather wait until all of the courts weigh in on this before they take that up. But that is a potential fix to the law as it stands right now that would address some of the concerns that are raised in the challenge, that is, how it is preventing people from voting because of the inconvenience or the burden. If they can just go in and swear the affidavit, then maybe all those people who, like ourselves, who can get a voter ID would still have to get one. But there'd be this sort of pressure valve that would affect the others.
So that would maybe affect that poll tax
as well. Right. Yeah, that was brought up too today in the arguments that that perhaps the state could agree to. In fact, Chief Justice Abrahamson sort of suggested that during the arguments today, that the state could say, well, if people don't have enough money to get their birth certificates, then we could put in the law that the state will pay for whatever ID is necessary.
So she says that the state could put it in law. Ultimately, that means the legislature
would have
to put it in the
right,
law.
Right, right. And so any ruling would probably indicate that this is something that the legislature has to do.
Do we have a timeline on when the state Supreme Court decision might come down on this? I think you mentioned that we don't know about the federal one.
Right. And the federal one may come down sooner, although it's possible that Justice Abelman is waiting for to really see what the state Supreme Court ruling is. But, I mean, generally, the state Supreme Court rulings, when they're argued at this time of year, aren't going to come out until the summer.
Well, we'll probably talk to you again then, if not before. Gilman, as always, thanks for joining us. That's Gilman Halstead from the WPR News team.